We cannot see or touch spaceships or space people when they are in their higher frequencies because they exist outside of the range of our human senses. However, they have a reality and solidity of their own. Within their own band of vibratory frequency, they are visible, solid, and tangible to beings who live on their level. These remarks, of course, apply only to space beings living in higher frequencies, not to other three-dimensional beings. When they come to Earth and make themselves visible and tangible to us, they have to descend into our octave of frequency. This activity we call emergence. Our present understanding of the nature of emergence includes the following four steps. Steps of emergence. 1. Decrease in vibratory frequency or rate of motion to conform to Earth's conditions. 2. Decrease in density. 3. Loss of energy. 4. Polarization or change in plane or form of energy motion to conform to Earth matter. Our understanding is that step 1 brings the spaceship and its personnel into our range of visibility. Step 4 makes the spaceship tangible to us. When they leave our Earth to return to the higher frequencies of outer space from which they come, they must go through a reverse action which we call transcendence. We understand that transcendence involves four steps as follows. 1. Increase in vibratory frequency. 2. Increase in density. 3. Absorption of energy. 4. Polarization back to the form of energy motion or matter from which the spaceship came. We understand that step 1 nullifies visibility of the ship and its personnel so far as human sight is concerned. Step 4 nullifies tangibility so far as human touch is concerned. It is possible, however, for a spaceship to complete step 1 without completing step 4. In this case, we have a phenomenon far in advance of most human knowledge, namely tangibility without visibility. The reverse is also possible. In other words, there are conditions of high frequency matter in which we cannot see an object, but we can feel it. Also, there are conditions in which we can see spaceships or space people, but they have little tangibility or solidity from our viewpoint. Remember that one great characteristic of advanced space beings is their complete mastery of energy or matter. Spectrums of sense. We have discussed the important subject of the limitations of the human senses and how they present only a narrow band of awareness of existence, like only band radio which can only tune into one frequency of broadcast programs. A more technical name for these limitations would be spectrums of the senses. Most of us are familiar with the fact that there is a spectrum of human hearing. Human hearing only detects or responds to sound vibrations within a given range of frequencies. Some readers may be familiar with dog whistles which give forth a note of such high pitch that the human ear cannot hear it at all. In this case, the sound cannot be heard because it is higher than the human sound spectrum. It tops the spectrum. It is above the upper end of the spectrum. Remember, however, that a spectrum has a high and a low end, and that we can lose awareness of an activity of energy such as sound either because it is above the high end or below the low end of our human spectrum. Thus, there are sounds too high or too fast for us to hear and also sounds too low or too slow for us to hear. There actually are sounds we cannot hear, but they do exist. They do have reality just the same. Just as sound is a manifestation of energy, so is everything else in existence, from the hardest piece of metal to the most exotic perfume or the most transcendent thought or concept or feeling. All is energy created and cognized by consciousness. To us, this is the beachhead of knowledge in our present sea of ignorance. We must recognize the limited spectrum of the human senses. This is the first rung up the ladder to cosmic knowledge. We have mentioned the human spectrum of sound. There are also human spectrums of smell, taste, sight and feeling. There are odors and fragrances we cannot smell, and there are flavors we cannot taste. There are also colors and things we cannot see which exist outside of our spectrum of sight. We are all familiar with solid fan blades which when stationary seem solid and visible to us and obscure any object behind them. But when we add motion or vibration to the blades by revolving them, they disappear to our sight and we can even see the objects behind them. In this state of increased motion, the blades have transcended the upper end of our spectrum of visibility but not our spectrum of tangibility. We cannot see them, but we can feel them. If you doubt this, put your fingers in the revolving blades. Why is it, friends, that most of us are perfectly familiar with these simple things, and yet if anyone suggests that a spaceship can exist in a vibratory state of matter in which it is invisible but tangible, well, many people start running as if they had seen a ghost. Densities and the spectrum of tangibility. This leads us to the subject of the densities of high-frequency matter out of which spaceships are made. The difficulty which many people have in grasping the density angle revolves around our spectrum of tangibility or touch or feeling. We are all familiar with solid objects passing beyond the upper range of our spectrum of tangibility and thus becoming intangible, because they become more vaporous, more evanescent and therefore less dense. Take for example ice. We heat it and speed up its energy acetivity. It melts and changes to a liquid, water. More heat is applied and it expands and becomes a vapor, steam. P. 217. We can put our hand through this vapor if it is cool enough. It is intangible. A substance ice in a solid form became water and then steam, an intangible form if the same substance. In this state it is above the upper range of human tangibility. But this is not the way in which a spaceship becomes intangible. When a spaceship transcends our spectrum of both visibility and tangibility, it goes through a mutation which increases the energy, frequency and also a polarization which changes the type of motion of the energy out of which it is constructed. The net result is a form of matter which has a higher frequency and a greater density. This causes invisibility and intangibility so far as the human senses are concerned. But the high-frequency matter of the spaceship in this condition is not more vaporous than before. On the contrary, it is denser than before. High-frequency matter is denser than Earth matter and can pass right through the openings in Earth matter. It becomes intangible to us because it passes beyond the lower, denser end of our spectrum of tangibility. If this is too much for the layman, we suggest he leave it alone. However, engineers and scientists should be interested in it. At this point, a friend exclaimed, in other words, a spaceship in the transcended state can pass through us like a wind through a wire fence. Is that it? That is not too bad, I replied, provided you recognize in your simile exactly which thing corresponds to the wind and which to the wire fence. The spaceship represents the wire fence because it is denser. Earth matter represents the wind because it is porous and vaporous compared to the high-frequency substance of the spaceship. Notes on spacecraft technology. One thing to note is that in outer space throughout countless ages there have been spacecraft of every conceivable type, size, shape and design using many different operating principles. Spacecraft are not confined to cigar-shaped ships or saucer-like ships. A study of Desmond Leslie's historical research will give some ideas of the great variety. One of the greatest puzzles to mankind has been the acceleration of spacecraft when flying in a conventional space-time type of flight. Their speeds in Earth's atmosphere have been clocked upwards of 20,000 miles per hour. The tight turns, sudden stops and sudden changes in direction they are able to effect at these great speeds would produce gravity pressures or Gs, from our viewpoint, which no human being could live through. Another puzzle has been what type of protection or protective atmosphere they employ to ward off cosmic debris existing in outer space. We feel that the works of Daniel Fry have covered these points so well that there is no need of duplicating the explanations in detail. Briefly, he states that the space people have solved the G problem by applying accelerating or decelerating energies to every atom of the ship and its contents simultaneously, including the personnel. Thus there exists no differential of acceleration between the ship and the personnel. Therefore, no Gs are experienced inside the ship despite its impossible maneuvers. As to the protective atmosphere surrounding the ship, it does exist in the form of a repellent type of energy. Thus spaceships carry with them their own gravitational field and their own protective field. Duplication of spaceships. Being an engineer, When I first started to study saucers, I was tremendously enthused with the possibility of quickly duplicating spacecraft and sailing around in outer space. I do not wish to lessen anyone's enthusiasm along this line, but may I say that so far as I am concerned, our research has, to put it mildly, tempered this early enthusiasm with the discovery that there are a lot of missing links. Thus, while being a tremendous believer in the philosophy that a difficult task takes a little while, and an impossible task takes a little longer, nevertheless it now appears that the element of a little longer may require more patience than seemed required at first. To begin with, it has become evident that spacecraft technology is highly involved with the requirement of very special materials, materials which have the heat resistance and the electrical, magnetic, frequency and physical qualities necessary. We doubt that mankind at present possesses the know-how needed to produce these materials, even if the required elements exist on Earth. Further, there is that little matter of tying into some anti-gravity energy or producing an anti-gravity force from known energy sources. Also, about the only propulsion we now know is jet propulsion, whereas interstellar spacecraft are way ahead of us, using universal energy or light energy. Then there is another consideration which few people have ever thought about, but it is very important. It is this. We discovered atomic energy, which was a discovery well up in the cosmic range of things. We started throwing it around rather freely without cosmic wisdom in proportion to its cosmic power, and suddenly we ran into the guardians of the planets and their cosmic navies. Now the question arises, just how far will our elder brothers in the space shaft permit us to go in spacecraft technology before we have balanced our scientific know-how with a little more cosmic wisdom, or shall we say cosmic morality? This seems to us a question worth pondering. One step at a time. We understand that in past ages on this Earth our ancestors had some spacecraft which were not interplanetary. They were confined to operating in the atmosphere of the Earth. Nevertheless, they represented a vast step in advance of our balloons, propeller-driven planes, jet planes, helicopters and rockets, because they overcame gravity and operated on the magnetic lines of force of the Earth. Now it seems to us that we must progress one step at a time, and that this type of non-interplanetary spacecraft is a legitimate goal for us at the present time. It is far more within our grasp than intergalactic teleporting spaceships. Furthermore, if the human race can get over its mania for killing each other, we might even get the space people to help us speed up such a development. We understand the technique was known in past ages, so it should not be too difficult to rediscover it. The conquest of outer space. This is a glorious adventure for mankind. We have some hurdles to overcome, but after all, what is more fun than overcoming difficulties? There is the psychological hurdle and the need of overcoming space sickness, which we understand can be worse than Maldemar. Then there is the heat barrier and the need of protection from space debris. One of the worst hurdles will probably be cosmic rays. Some of the bodies in space which we may wish to visit, like the moon, have too little atmosphere and too little ionosphere properly to shield the human body. We will need new lightweight materials for protection against cosmic rays. We certainly cannot use 15 feet of lead, which we understand it takes if we only have lead. The conquest of outer space is important, and who gets the first is important. We feel that the race to get into outer space will be won by those who cooperate most with outer space, not those who attack it by brute force. Outer space is not three-dimensional. And it is not empty. It is energy in vibration and in modes of motion that we must learn to tune into. Tuning into it is equivalent to getting there. The way into outer space is not by rockets or jet planes. There is the difference of day and night between a rocket trying to tear its way into outer space by brute force and a majestic fuelless spaceship gliding silently on unseen lines of force. The way into outer space is up the elevator of vibratory frequencies. Also, the race into outer space will be won by those who conform most to cosmic law and thereby make themselves most worthy of high knowledge. Also, we believe that OSC will play an important part in our conquest of our cooperation with outer space. Chapter 28. We visit Orfeo Angelusi. We shall now discuss Orfeo Angelusi and his truly remarkable saucer experiences. We became acquainted with him through the assistance of mutual friends who are themselves deeply interested in saucers and know many sorcerers personally. We feel very grateful for the help they have given us in preparing this book. On September 19, 1955, we drove to our friend's home in Los Angeles, where we spent some very profitable hours with both Mr. and Mrs. Angelusi. We feel that no saucer researcher can afford to neglect Angelusi's great contribution to our human knowledge of this subject. We found the Angelusis to be very charming, home-loving people of Italian ancestry and the parents of two boys. They had come to California about 8 years previously from Trenton, New Jersey, USA. We asked him how he had come by the unusual name of Orfeo, and he told us it was based on the name Orpheus from the old legend of Orpheus and Eurydice. Angelusi's background is not too different from that of many others who grew up in middle-class American homes. He quit school in New Jersey at the ninth grade, went to work and later married. He has always had an avid interest in scientific things, particularly the nature of the atom, and he has studied and experimented in his spare time. His big problem has always been his precarious health and his extremely nervous sensibilities, which have caused him endless suffering and pain both preceding and during any thunderstorm or electric storm. Whenever an electric storm approaches, he goes through a regular series of distressing symptoms, starting with a prickling sensation in his hands, arms, back and feet. It was this physical problem that led the family to move to California, where storms are less frequent. We mention this because these physical symptoms, 223, later were to become, for Angelusi, an almost infallible warning of the approach of a spacecraft or a prelude to a space contact. Angelusi is a trim, slender man with fine clean-cut features and deep expressive eyes. Strangely enough, some indefinable quality about him reminded both of us of Salvador Villanueva Medina, the Mexican chauffeur. Humanly, we found him a very friendly and downright likable sort of person, not at all difficult to meet or to make friends with. But as the evening wore on and the conversation turned to the higher aspects of the flying saucer phenomena, we discovered that we were indeed talking with an individual of great spiritual advancement, discernment and experience. By this we do not mean that he was what people call a religious person, far from it. There is a tremendous gap between religious orthodoxy and the type of cosmic advancement we found in Angelusi. We were grateful that our meeting with this advanced sorcerer had come when it did, toward the end of our saucer pilgrimage. We realized that if it had come at the start, it would have been too much for us, too advanced, and we probably would not have been able to follow or understand or appreciate his experiences, because most of them typified the superphysical aspects of saucers rather than the physical. One good way to learn, however, is to get acquainted with the men having the more advanced type of saucer experiences. So here we were talking with a man who for about 9 years had been under the direct observation of extraterrestrial beings and who had been privileged to have at least 8 contacts or intimate personal experiences with them. These experiences are set forth in detail in his book The Secret of the Saucers, which he copyrighted in 1955. In our estimation, Angelusi has done an exceptional and courageous job in revealing the intimate details of his experience and the nature of the advanced space beings he has contacted, their greatness, their perfection, and their, 224, compassionate love for mankind. Few books reveal what, for want of a better word, we might call the sacred matter of such contacts between a space being and an Earth being. It seems to us that Angelusi's experiences and his forthright and honest revelation of them belong not to the multitude of unawakened humans who invariably classify everything beyond the range of the 5 physical senses as either bunkum or heresy. Rather, they belong primarily to those with a certain natural or acquired capacity for understanding them. The saucer enthusiast who is still in that mental state where he absolutely insists that the saucers be served down to him, flat on the ground, and brimful of material sauce will doubtless find little that is either appetizing or palatable in Angela's saucer experiences. After all, if one's viewpoint is flat on the ground, that fact alone prohibits one from being able to follow saucers into the higher realms of life and consciousness from which many of them, but not all of them, do come. Others who have a certain degree of spiritual attainment of their own, or those who are familiar with states and stages of consciousness or who are students of metaphysics or philosophy will have no trouble in understanding this unusual sorcerer. Those who are familiar with the attainments of the masters or the advanced yogis or swamis, or those who are familiar with the works of Edgar Cayce, or those who have themselves more or less pierced the veils which hide the frequencies of life, such people will not only profit by Angela's experiences but will be very grateful for his efforts to share them with others. These people will take Angela's to their hearts. They will see in him a modern revelator, a veritable modem dweller on two planets, and they will rejoice in his revelations. To the earnest sorcerer searcher who is not afraid to follow the truth into the reaches of outer space but who has difficulty in understanding Angela's, we have this to say. The study of sorcerers is a subject of vast extent, in fact a 225, study of cosmic proportions. One would not expect to understand calculus without first learning step by step all the intermediate phases of mathematics. In the same way, one's understanding of advanced sorcerer experiences must come step by step. We must climb the ladder of cosmic truth one rung at a time. We feel that Angela's experiences are not for most beginners, but of course there are exceptions. For those who are starting from scratch but sincerely wish to understand, the following three suggestions might prove of value. 1. First, study the physical aspect of sorcerers. They have a definite physical side. Learn all about this from every possible source, study the sightings and the ABC books. 2. Then progress gently from the physical aspects, which are the least important, into the supraphysical aspects. Our book has been designed to help the reader do this. Gradually study the more advanced books, and above all try to grasp the outstanding cosmic fact that life exists in octaves or bands of vibratory frequency. These correspond to different planes of consciousness. 3. Then realize this. In most of Angela's contacts, the great space beings did not descend fully into our octave of life or into our octave of vibratory frequency to meet him. The space beings came down only partway and Angela's went up partway. Thus they met on a plane of frequency or of consciousness slightly above the physical, where complete three-dimensional solidity, tangibility and visibility were not attained and were not necessary. As Angela's himself has expressed it, I saw them clearly, but as though I were viewing them through rippling water. It reminded him of an imperfectly tuned television set. Angela's experiences. Let us now briefly review a few of his remarkable experiences. His first flying saucer experience took place way back in Trenton, New Jersey, on August 4, 1946. Please remember that this date was months before flying saucers, 226, were heard of or even so named by modern man. At the time Angela's was quite an experimenter in certain scientific fields, and he was particularly interested in the subject of fungi and mold cultures. Desiring to learn the effect of upper atmospheric conditions on certain mold cultures, he bought some navy-type balloons with the idea of carrying the cultures, packed in baskets attached to the balloons, to predetermined altitudes and then hauling them down for further study. The balloons, however, with their attached baskets broke away and he and his family and friends sorrowfully watched this seemingly unhappy ending to his scientific efforts. As the balloons rose higher and higher in the sky, they all noticed a strange aircraft hovering overhead near them. It actually seemed to be following the balloons. The craft was round, and it had no wings. They watched and wondered about it, but it soon disappeared in the distance. In the days that followed, most everyone forgot about the incident. How could Angelus I know then that he had just seen a flying saucer roar that a day would come years later when he would meet the space being who was controlling the strange craft? Almost 6 years elapsed before his second experience. Those who are so impatient for saucer experiences may well ponder this fact. He had moved to California and was working in the Lockheed Aircraft Corporation plant at Burbank in the suburban area of Los Angeles. On May 23, 1952, late at night, he felt the strange physical symptoms which usually preceded an electrical storm. He went outside the plant to investigate and was surprised to find an unusually clear and beautiful night. It puzzled him that there was no storm to account for the distressing symptoms. His shift ended at 12:30 a.m., and he started driving home in his car following well-known city boulevards. The painful symptoms still persisted. As he neared the city limits of Los Angeles, he caught sight of an oval-shaped object traveling ahead of him in the air. It was luminous and, 227, was emitting a red color. Apparently no one else noticed it. He followed it across the Los Angeles River to the outskirts of a park region. Here the object veered off the main highway, down a lonely park drive, and finally hung motionless over a field. Angelus I decided to follow it and parked his car a short distance from the amazing, hovering, pulsating object which seemed only partially solid. Suddenly it shot skyward at an angle, then paused while two smaller objects like balls of fire came from it. Then as the original object accelerated out of sight, the two fireballs descended and hovered in the air only a few feet from the astounded Angelus I. They were fluorescent green in color and about 3 feet in diameter. The contact that followed was both audible and visual. The visual phase came about through a luminous screen effect between the glowing spheres in which Angelus I saw a projected picture of his space of visitors as on a television screen. This phase, however, lasted only a few minutes. But a voice came from the glowing green objects and the two-way communication which ensued lasted for almost an hour. Some of the highlights of this contact may be of interest. First, Angelus I learned that these beings were none other than those controlling the saucer which followed his lost balloons back in New Jersey in 1946. Moreover, he had been under their observation ever since that event. They gave him a cup of shining liquid to drink which relieved his symptoms. Oral speech hardly seemed necessary. Before he could voice a question, the answer would come. Apparently he was in some sort of telepathic communication with them. He experienced the uncomfortable feeling that they knew his every thought, his past, everything about him, even things he did not know himself. The green spheres were explained as instruments of transmission and reception which were used to relay visual, auditory and telepathic impressions to a mothership for permanent, 228, recording. Angelus I was not the only Earthling this group of space beings was in the process of contacting. There was another individual in Italy, and still another in India. The chief basis of these contacts was higher vibrational perception on the part of these Earthlings. Angelus I was told that the space beings had noted man's humorous and skeptical treatment of flying saucers on Earth, but they did not criticize this because of the need of our becoming gradually aware of them. Spacecraft of other planetary evolutions were also visiting the Earth, all on a friendly and helpful basis. Many have seen them. But the ships were capable of various states of invisibility. Speeds approaching that of light could be attained by many spacecraft. However, the more advanced space beings function in dimensions unknown to man and have no need of spacecraft of any type but on occasions employ them for purposes of material manifestations to men. In the higher phases of life the time dimension becomes non-existent, and there are incredibly rapid means of travel beyond man's present comprehension. The reason for their coming is that life evolution on Earth has reached a dangerous crisis. We have given the above with some detail in order to convey to our readers something of the great range of information which it is possible to obtain through a space contact. Angelus I's third experience was a trip in a remote-controlled flying saucer. It took place on July 23, 1952, 2 months after his audio-visual contact. The takeoff and landing points were in a secluded spot along the dry river bed of the Los Angeles River, only a few blocks from his home, well within the city limits of Los Angeles. Before he saw the saucer on the ground, he experienced the familiar tingling sensation in his arms and legs. The shape of the craft resembled an Eskimo igloo, about 30 feet high and 30 feet in diameter at the base, and appeared to him to be constructed of a translucent substance.